I studied architecture, but then I went into something that wasn't conventional practice. And it's been really hard to define what it is that I'm interested in within architecture, because a lot of people would think that what I'm doing isn't architecture, but I spent all my time in an architecture school doing architectural projects, but in a very different way to like building buildings.
That's Manjeet Verghese, and this is the On Design podcast. Hi, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the On Design podcast. I'm your host, Justina Green. It's the 1st of December as this episode is released. And listen, everyone, we almost made it through this year. So well done to all of us. Whatever this year has chucked at you, you're still here, which is amazing. So well done. And I really hope you can take some time off in the festive season and recharge for 2022. That's my plan for sure. We'll see how it goes. This season of the On Design podcast is slowly coming to an end. But trust me, we're going to do it with a bang with a few more incredible episodes. And today, our guest is Manjeet Verghese, who's the head of public programs at the Architectural Association. And she's also the co-founder of Unseen Architecture, a practice that operates across disciplines to reveal the unseen forces that shape our cities. She's also the co-curator of this year's British Pavilion at the Venice Biennale of Architecture, which focused on the privatized public spaces. She's an absolute force, and you will just love our conversation. I'm a huge fan of Manjeet, so without further ado, here's our chat. It's being in town, being in London, yeah. in this area here. I was just admiring all the architecture, kind of looking left and right and thinking that I've not seen those type of buildings for a good year and a half, yeah. Living in Southeast London.
I know, it's really surreal to be in central London, like after sitting in my flat for the last year and a half.
Yeah, so how often are you here now?
I'm usually here like maybe once or twice a week because yeah. I teach on Tuesdays, so that's the day I usually come in. And then I try and come in one other day, but we don't have any offices anymore because all of the offices became studio spaces.
Yeah, so for listeners, we're now currently at the Architectural Association in Bedford Square in London. And there might be a little bit of echo because we're in this massive, huge room.
It's a real luxury after the last year.
For the two of us,
right? In a small flat.
I know, and high ceilings,
exactly.
Right? This is fantastic. And I'm super excited that we're making it happen. We tried to record on Zoom, but it didn't quite work out because Wi-Fi, the usual kind of pandemic troubles. But it's really nice to be here face-to-face, and I wanted to speak to you for a really long time. Especially when you did the Venice Biennale installation. That just blew my mind, and the kind of the Hieronymus Bosch references, I was all over them. So we'll chat about that today as well. But firstly, I'd love listeners to get to know you more. And so I wonder, when did your interest in architecture start? And what was your environment growing up and how that inspired you or not?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was trying to reflect on when did I first get interested in architecture. And I think neither of my parents are architects. They're actually both in business, but they both are kind of interested in design and have always like surrounded themselves with like interesting objects and things like that. They both grew up in India, but they moved to England before I was born. And so I was born here, but then they split up when I was around five. And so I ended up moving to India with my mom and my sister. And it was just, it was incredible actually for us because we got to grow up across two countries and got to know our whole family. And my grandparents actually live in a house designed by Charles Currier because my grandmother's sister was married to him. And so I think I was always just like influenced by it because it was in my immediate surroundings without necessarily being conscious of it. And it was only much later, like when I was in university, that I started to think of it as a potential career. But it's kind of, I guess, always just been something that I've been that I've been exposed to, which I'm quite lucky.
That's the thing, right? When you're exposed to it and when it's kind of just part of your life, you might not even notice how it influences you.
Yeah, exactly. I think I don't know. It's just kind of funny that like all these things that later on I realized I was quite lucky to be around, like these incredible way of looking at space, or this kind of openness that you find in like hotter countries where the kind of buildings are kind of open out onto green spaces that you kind of take for granted. And then seeing that contrasted to a totally different type of architecture in the UK, because I used to come back every summer to visit my dad.
Okay.
And then he used to take me and my sister on these like mini trips so that we could like get to see Europe and travel. And so you suddenly start to get exposed to all of these different things. And I guess it all shapes like what you end up doing and becoming. But I guess that's just with the benefit of hindsight.
That's right. It's as Steve Jobs said, I think that the dots, you know, you connect them, looking back, they all make sense. Right. And then, so when did you decide, so you did your BA in architecture already?
When I finished school in India, I was 17, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I decided to study in America because you get 2 years to decide if you do a liberal arts like degree. And so I ended up going to Wellesley College, which is in Massachusetts. And the best thing about liberal arts is you get to dabble in a bit of everything. And I really liked maths as a subject. And so I started doing a degree in maths. And then as that progressed, it became like very abstract. And I was kind of wondering where this was going to lead to as a career path. And in the meantime, I was like volunteering to read to children with learning difficulties, like on the side. And the student who used to drive us there was in her final year and she was studying architecture. And so on our drives there, she would chat to me about the studio courses she was doing at MIT because you could cross register. And she had done this study abroad experience through Columbia University that was like across New York and Paris. And all of it sounded really exciting, but I always thought architecture was very technical and that I'd have to do all this physics, and I didn't do physics in my A-levels, so I was concerned. And she was like, no, it's fine. Like, you can just do this class that you're planning to take anyway. And so she actually, like, changed my entire, like, career path.
Amazing.
Because of her, I basically just did everything she did. And I enrolled on this study abroad program that completely changed my life because it helped me build my portfolio. I did all these studios at MIT, and so it kind of, I ended up doing a degree in architecture, and I did a minor in maths, and haven't really used it since. But weirdly, I've recently remembered it on a project I'm doing in Manchester that I guess we can speak about later. But it's kind of funny how the people you meet really shift the course
of your life right?
In like completely random ways. Like, if I hadn't met her and done this like thing as an extracurricular activity, maybe I would never have studied architecture. So maybe I'd be like a mathematician or a maths teacher.
Or a philosopher, because you'd go so deep into maths.
That's true. It becomes very philosophical. You're like having to prove all these concepts and things. I don't think I was very good at that. So,
but that's a beautiful story of kind of how it's happened so naturally. And probably at the time without you thinking that this is a big decision based on not much, apart from it sounding exciting.
Yeah, exactly. I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to always like make these huge decisions and try and play out their impact over time. Whereas actually, if you just kind of see where things take you, they often lead to really exciting things. And I've been teaching this professional practice course all day when doing tutorials with students about what their 5-year plan might be. And I keep telling them, like, I remember being in their position and being really anxious about what was I going to do and how would that lead to the next thing. And some of the greatest things, including the British Pavilion that happened to me, like, I never in my wildest dreams expected that would happen. And it's, I guess, how do you leave room in your plan for the unexpected or for the chance encounter?
Yeah.
Because that often leads you to a much greater opportunity than, you know, something that you can actually plan
and
for.
And what's your advice there? Kind of getting into top tips now, because it's I find it really, really interesting. And I've tried to plan things. And I had this thing when I would plan stuff around my illustration. And then I wouldn't do anything of it because I'd get attracted to different things. And I thought I was bad at sticking to plans. But turns out I was better at following kind of that path. But what's your advice for people who are a bit anxious about it?
And so I'm a very anxious person, and I really like making plans. I think it helps me feel like there is a way forward. But I think it's also having, having a sense that also if you don't exactly follow the plan, it's fine. And actually that sometimes having that room for flexibility actually leads you to opportunities that you could never have imagined. And I think it gets easier as you get a bit older, because when you're younger, you just really feel like, what if this is a dead end? What if this doesn't lead to anything? And I think especially now with social media and stuff, you're constantly measuring yourself against other people's success. And there's no like one way that success, there's no one way that success can manifest itself, or that there's no like one definition of what that looks like. And I think a lot of it comes from just, I guess, also understanding what success means to you. And I think it's a big struggle. Like I've struggled with that a lot. Like I think I studied architecture, but then I went into something that wasn't conventional practice. And it's been really hard to define what it is that I'm interested in within architecture. Because a lot of people would think that what I'm doing isn't architecture, but I spent all my time in an architecture school doing architectural projects, but in a very different way to like building buildings. And so it's been, as you described it, I've kind of, my career path has taken lots of twists and turns mm-hmm. along the way. And I think there's constantly this, I have these existential crises every so often where I'm like, what am I doing with my life? Like, who understands what this is and is this a career path? But I think as you continue to add things to it, it becomes a very different type of career path. And more students, I find, are interested in not just doing one thing, but doing lots of things and trying to find a way to string them together and make connect the dots, as you said,
yep.
And find a way for that to make sense to potential audiences that they might want to reach.
So. And so thinking about that kind of unconventional path, and for people who don't know your work, how would you then describe it or try to describe it? Because you interned or worked at Foster's.
Yeah, so right? When I graduated from Wellesley, I thought I would go straight into doing a master's in architecture. And then I kind of felt like actually I needed a bit of a break and I wanted to gain professional experience. So I decided to move to London for a year. And I applied to Foster's and I applied to a whole bunch of places. And I ended up working there. I think like most people in architecture have worked at Foster's at some point or the other. And it was kind of just like being thrown in at the deep end. I got to like detail like 200 apartments. I got to try out all of these different things. And it was also a bit like being in university because everyone was quite young and you worked really hard, but you also like went out all the time. And some of my best friends till today are people that I met there. And yeah, it actually changed the whole course of my life again, because mm-hmm. I, instead of being there for a year, I basically have stayed there till now. And I met all these people who went to the Bartlett and went to the AA. And I decided I was going to apply. When I decided to apply to do my master's, I decided to not just apply to American schools, but apply to lots of schools in Europe as well. And then when I came here for my interview, it was really, I just had like a good sense of the place. And it was kind of like my interview was more like a tutorial. Like they were giving me all this advice about like how I could develop my work. And it was like a really nice environment. And so it kind of convinced me to stay here.
And what was your work like then when you came to that interview? Kind of what was in your portfolio and what were you interested in at the time?
I think my portfolio was just kind of a random mix of things I had done professionally and some like very like crude student projects. And but I had written this essay to get into university about my grandmother, like, and how watching her kind of put on a sari every day and like how much of my own identity and culture was like embedded in that act of like draping a sari. And I was really interested in that as a sculptural thing and as a way to think three-dimensionally and how that could be applied to architecture. And I remember in my interview they told me that my writing was really personal and evocative and my portfolio maybe wasn't, and if I came to the AA I should try and work on that. And it was a really great like piece of advice, because I think I was still trying to figure out what I thought about architecture, where in architecture I saw myself. And the AA really changed my whole view of architecture, because it showed me that architecture can be everything. Like, it's a way of thinking about the world around you. And the skills you learn as an architect can be applied to so many things. And it's about figuring out where you want to position yourself to make the most difference. And it kind of also maybe ruined my chances of going back to conventional practice, because I guess having studied here, I felt like I couldn't go back to doing what I was doing before and I wanted to try something different. And a lot of people, I still tell students as well, that when you first graduate from architecture school, you should take a lot of risks and try things out. And so I think the director at the time told me that as a student, I had done lots of things and I shouldn't just go and do one thing when I graduated. And I probably followed his advice to a fault. And now I'm trying to think, what would it be like to just do one thing? But it was like, I started working in publishing. So I worked for Decennial magazine. That came out of an internship I did at Icon. I amazingly got a job assisting a unit at the AA, which was really great to get experience teaching so immediately after graduating. And I was like organizing events and doing other things and trying to create conversations about like AA life through setting up a website here. And then over time, those jobs evolved and became different things. And then I started working on the public program here, which was an incredible opportunity to really think about the questions architecture should be asking and how that can expand to become an interdisciplinary conversation.
And tell me about that role now, because that's the role you're in currently as head of public programs, right?
Yeah, so it's like kind of a role that's evolved. It started off as just me doing it, and now there's like a whole team of people that are incredible that I get to work with every day. But it's what I love about the AA Public Program is that it's a completely free form of education. Like, all our lectures and exhibitions are free for anyone to attend. And it means that I can take a lot of risks in terms of who I can invite to come participate in the program. So I get critiqued quite a lot by students that sometimes I don't invite at the big names that everyone knows, but you can probably Google them and find their lecture on YouTube. And I think throughout history, way before I ever started doing the public program, the AA has often been a place where people have done their first lecture rather than their 100th lecture.
Yeah.
And I think it's because we have the freedom to, we don't have to charge tickets or fill a lecture hall. We can invite people to, like, who are doing really interesting things that are on the cusp of maybe becoming the next big thing, to do a talk. And more recently, especially, I've been really interested in providing a platform for people who really need it, who are doing some incredible things that could totally shift inequalities in society or the models around which we currently operate. And I feel really lucky to be able to do that, and it's really inspiring. And I think I have a lot of freedom to do that, which is great. And the types of lectures, I mean, I get to go to lectures as my job, which is incredible. And it's just great to get to listen to people talk about all the incredible things they're doing and provide platforms for different types of conversations to happen.
So could you tell both me and the listeners, like, just drop some names of people who are absolutely amazing, doing brilliant stuff that we might not know about, and just roughly what they're working on, so that we can all get Googling.
Yeah, well, last year I started this series called New Models, and that came out of, I guess, a lot of these crises we're facing on multiple fronts, whether that's about climate or systemic injustice. And particularly coming out of the Black Lives Matter protests, I felt like there were lots of people doing really interesting work across disciplines, and that maybe part of how I see the role of the architect is to communicate and maybe bring people together around one table. And so trying to think, you know, how can this lecture series bring in these people to propose new models for society? And so it started with this incredible person called Eric Collins, who started a fund called ImpactX, so totally outside of architecture. But it's the first venture capitalist fund that's there to support entrepreneurs that are from Black or marginalized backgrounds, because lots of banks don't collect data on who actually gets funding. But if you do look at the data when it has been collected, there's a real discrepancy in terms of which ideas get funded. So he was just talking about, like, the proof is in the pudding. He saw a gap in the market and has started to fund companies, and the impact of that has been incredible. We also invited Tom Price, who's a sculptor who has really looked at how do we look at public art and look at how statues that have traditionally celebrated individual achievements can start to celebrate the anonymous individual or people who don't see themselves in the public realm, which felt really important, especially in that current moment. And he's now doing a residency at Hauser & Wirth in Somerset, which is really incredible. I encourage everyone to go see it. We've also had, like, architectural practitioners like Resolve Collective, who've really been speaking about, like, how do you really run kind of a practice that's kind of based in community, and that, you know, uses the community as a kind of platform to do architectural projects. And they kind of decided that rather than them just giving a lecture, they would invite some of their collaborators, so it became like a whole discussion. We had Sound Advice as part of that series, talking about how do you hold institutions to account, but do it in a playful way, but still a very serious way, using music. And so that was like a lecture / party. It was like the first time on Zoom that I felt like you could have like an after party. So, and that's just like a quick cross-section of some of the amazing people that have spoken as part of the series. And it's still going on. There's going to be one tonight by Dimas Ruji, who's been doing incredible work to kind of reclaim territory in Palestine through memories and through the making of artifacts. But she's proposing a new model for excavation and how we can rethink the way we excavate memories and provide a space for liberation.
That sounds absolutely incredible, all those guests, just absolutely mind-blowing, even just hearing kind of the concepts, not to mention being in the lecture. So what we'll do, we'll, in the show notes, we'll put in names and links to your lectures.
Yeah, I can send you, like, for this series in particular, there's like a link where you can watch all the videos, because we record all of them and they're on our YouTube channel.
So amazing. So listeners, that's what we're going to do, because it sounds incredible. And I want to so many things I want to talk about. But before we talk about the Biennale, let's talk about the case of the elusive room, because I want to for the listeners to get to know a bit more even of your practice based on kind of what you actually did. So what's the case of the elusive room?
So the case of the elusive room was my diploma project when I graduated from the AA. And it's funny because I remember someone saying to me when I was a student that all the ideas of your practice are embedded in your final student project, which is probably not a helpful thing to say to anyone in their final year, because then you've put all this pressure on yourself that this has to be some like life-defining project. But I think I was fortunate to work with my teacher at the time is someone called Natasha Sandmeyer, and she was really incredible in that she just really supported us to kind of just follow our path and figure it out along the way. And I remember when I graduated, she wrote something about my project that said that throughout the year, neither she nor I knew where my project was going. And I was quite offended by it at the time, but actually I see that now as a tutor, like how sometimes it's this blind faith that it will figure itself out. Like I had no idea what my project was gonna be. But it has actually been the source of a lot of the things I've done since, like every competition I've entered, every kind of project, whether it's a lecture or a installation or whatever it's been, has kind of, you can see like a trace of it in there, which I'm not always conscious about, but as part of like a seminar I was teaching, someone asked me what was the connection between my diploma project and the pavilion. And actually the case of the elusive room was like this detective case file that was inviting you to go through the city looking for this room that was accessible. And just while moving through a series of interiors and exteriors, there were always barriers in terms of who could access them. And then it was only towards the end that you try and solve the mystery of like, where is this room that everyone can be in together? Which it has obviously very strong connections to privatized public space and how we can open it up, which was really the focus of Maddie's and my proposal for the British Pavilion. So I think through the format and through the ideas I was trying to test as a much younger person, there were lots of things in there that still have relevance for me today, whether I'm conscious of them or not.
So let's talk about pavilion, because I think that links really nicely. So can you tell us about kind of what it was and what was the concept for it? And also, let's start with how did it happen?
Yeah, so so Maddie, who I co-curated the pavilion with, she and I met as students at the AA. And so it's kind of fitting that we're doing this interview here today. She likes to tell people that we met in a privatized public space because we met in the women's toilets on the diploma corridor because she was the year below me. And we became friends, and since graduating, we taught a lot of workshops and summer schools together. And in 2015, we taught a summer school looking at the pub as a positive example of privatized public space. And it was like an idea that we, at the time, like really enjoyed, and it's something that people hadn't really thought about. We often think of public spaces or privatized public spaces being these like paved squares in new developments. And then we actually went to Venice together for the last Architecture Biennale, and we were walking around, and as a joke, we said like we should enter. And then weirdly, because we went in November, and in December, the British Council announced the open call, and it was a lot earlier than they usually announce it. And so we both sent it to each other, and we were like, actually, maybe we should enter. But we definitely saw it as like the first attempt in many, and like at no point did we ever think we would even get shortlisted, let alone win it. And then, so we were really excited when we did get shortlisted, and we decided to take this topic of privatized public space and really look at how it was embedded in British culture, not just through the pub, but through spaces like the High Street, the Garden Square, which there's a great example of right outside the AA in Bedford Square, like the closures of youth centers, and really look at how do we open all these spaces up for other people to access and think about how they're owned, managed, used in different ways. And so the act of building a team and coming up with these ideas was really exciting. And obviously the Bosch painting that you mentioned previously, the Garden of Earthly Delights, was an amazing reference to help us conceptually think about how to stitch all of these ideas together and also give it a feeling of delight and a kind of a call to action for architects that actually architecture has to be really compelling and surreal and delightful to get people to engage with it. So yeah, we put together our submission, we amazingly got shortlisted, and then it all became quite real because we had to then put together a proposal and present to the British Council and to this really intimidating panel of like people we really respected in architecture. And yeah, I think it was like a total, like, I mean, there were some amazing people who were also shortlisted. A lot of our friends were shortlisted. And I remember the night before, they were going to tell whoever won it on a Friday. And on Thursday evening, I remember both of us were really upset and we were speaking to each other on the phone, consoling each other that we were going to find a way to make this idea happen in some other form. And so when I got this call from the British Council, I was so shocked. And they had some issues with their email, so they didn't actually send us the official email that we had gotten it until many hours later. And the longer we waited to get that email, the more I was like, did I imagine this? Like, have I just imagined, or did someone play a prank on me? And so in the end, I ended up having to email them being like, just checking that like this actually happened. So yeah, and then it was like a completely surreal experience. I think it was a good catalyst for Maddie and I to start a practice in order to deliver the project. But
so is that how it started?
Yeah. Unseen Architecture was very much born out of the British Pavilion. We were totally not set up to do this project, and it's been a real learning experience. But we have been fortunate to have incredible collaborators. Like, our team have been amazing, despite all the obstacles that have come our way, from Brexit to COVID to anything else you can imagine. And also just the profession as a whole is incredibly generous. Like, everyone gave up so much of their time to help us, to give us contacts that we could like reach out to for funding, for support, have sat to give us like critiques on our design. And so the whole thing was like a real collaborative effort and really wouldn't have been possible without so many people wanting to help us. And in that respect, the Pavilion is an amazing platform, because there were so many people who we invited to be on our team that were doing really interesting work, but maybe not the whole world didn't necessarily know about it. And it gave us an opportunity to kind of show all of that and stitch it together. And our catalog was designed as a kind of manual to say, like, the average person can take over a gap site in the city and make it into a really interesting public space if they have the right tools and are able to reach the right people to have these conversations. So yeah, it's very much the beginning of something, rather than, it's kind of sad because last week I was in Venice and to close the Pavilion. And it was a really emotional moment for Maddie and I, having waited so long to see this project happen, to then be there. And it was ending in that form. But we're really hoping that it's going to come back to the UK to get experienced by all the audiences that didn't make it out to Venice, and to actually become something more than just an exhibition, but to become a series of live projects.
That would be incredible. So the Pavilion is just the start, right?
I hope so.
Yeah.
It's definitely been, during the delay caused by coronavirus, it was like a really, while we were obviously very upset that it was postponed, it felt like, you know, there were so many bigger things happening in the world. But if anything, it underlined the urgency of this topic and a lot of the spaces that were already under threat before, like the pub or the high street, are even more so now. But what it's done is actually cast a light on that, and the government, like local governments especially, are really like putting funding towards reinvigorating high streets, looking at how like communities can come together to create networks of mutual support to enable things to happen. And so we use that time to really have conversations with different like kind of stakeholders in public space, and we're really lucky to get involved in the Mayor of London's kind of draft public London Charter. Which was kind of perfectly timed, because that was happening right when we got the commission, and then it was kind of being developed in parallel, and we've got to sit in on loads of their conversations with really fascinating people. So again, timing is like everything, and the Pavilion has enabled us to be part of all of these conversations and hopefully take some of these ideas forward and test them out in real privatized public spaces.
And so that we understand more of the Pavilion as well, especially people who haven't seen it yet, I'll put links in show notes to the videos, because you can have a walkthrough to the Pavilion, which I did. Can you just talk us through each space? Because we've mentioned the high street, the pub, and private squares. Just talk us through each of the spaces, because like you just mentioned, it's so relevant how we've been living, all of us, in the past year, 2 years.
Yeah, so the six rooms in the Pavilion, and the whole thing, I guess, is stitched together by this painting by Hieronymus Bosch, The Garden of Earthly Delights. And the setup of it as a triptych was really like looking at this, the binary of heaven and hell and the middle ground of earth as this rich territory for people to inhabit and explore. And so we abstracted that into our concept, the Garden of Privatized Delights, by looking at how often there's too much of a binary conversation around public being good and private being bad, and actually privatized public space is a real opportunity for the two sectors to work together and for architects to really bring different groups around the table, including local communities, to make sure that there isn't this one-size-fits-all approach and that there's a way to kind of really rethink how these spaces exist and can be opened up. So when you enter the pavilion, you're really entering into that middle ground of the painting, and that's what we tried to set up in the experience. And then you come into the Garden Square, which are these amazing green oases in the city, but they're often, like, you know, surrounded by railings that limit your access to them. And in the pavilion, we tried to play on that because it's like you come in and you can see this huge structure, but you can't quite get access it. So you're forced to kind of quickly move on to the next room. And then it's only having been to all the other rooms that you find yourself back inside there. So we wanted to kind of create that initial negative experience in terms of, like, framing the problem. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of move along this path throughout all the rooms, and it's kind of, it suggests different speeds to experience the pavilion. So you can go through the whole thing quickly by staying on the path, but you can also choose to step off the path and engage in each of the rooms because there's interactive elements throughout. So from there you go into the pub, and that was, like, designed by the decorators. And they were really looking at how the pub has become home to a series of, like, I guess, marginalized groups over time, whether it's the LGBTQ community, and they had banners from the Joiners Arms in Hackney that was closed down, but because of their protests and activism, they were able to protect the use of that space as a kind of important LGBTQ space, and as a result, like, whatever gets built there will be there for that community. But there was a whole host of other examples. They have a sign from a Desi pub in the Midlands that was really, like, thinking of how the pub can move away from a place of drinking, excessive drinking and gang violence, and become more of a community center and as a way to showcase Indian culture in a place where it's not always understood. And so they have, like, a bunch of really interesting examples around this bar structure, but they also have karaoke that invites you to sing along and learn more about the history of the pub as an important political and civic space. And then from there, you move into a digital room that was designed by Buildworks called the Ministry of Collective Data. And in addition to all these existing spaces, we wanted to create two ministries that would look at a kind of more bottom-up approach to decision-making. They're, like, proposed ministries in the hope that they exist in the future. So this was looking at facial recognition technology and how, like, who owns our data and how it's used is so not transparent, and we need to make it more transparent. And so it asks you about issues of consent and whether you would consent to your data being captured if you owned it and you knew how it would be used for public benefit. And so there's lots of, like, your data gets captured and translated into an avatar, and then there's, like, ways in which you can choose, like, how it will be used. And then from there, you move into the High Street of Exchanges that was designed by Studio Polpo, who are based in Sheffield. And they were really looking at projects that they've done along the Sheffield High Street, like Food Hall, which is an amazing project. That's a kind of pay-as-you-feel cafe, but a space of knowledge and skills exchange. And it was really looking at how the High Street can move on from being a place of, like, monetary transactions, which it already has because so much retail has moved online, but instead become this really important social space. Like, libraries are really used as help desks. Hairdressers are used as spaces to have a conversation and combat loneliness. So they recreate some of these spaces as a way for us to think about that. And they worked with a sound artist to really bring Sheffield High Street to Venice. So there's these amazing yellow cones that you can sit under and listen to this audio. Then you move to the second ministry, which is the Ministry of Common Land that Public Works designed, and that's designed as a citizens' assembly. And it's really looking at how communities can look at gap sites in the city and take them over. And they have been doing this for several years, and they have this amazing image on the far wall that kind of documents the work they've been doing in Loughborough Junction in South London with a community over the last decade. And making things like a kind of community kitchen, an adventure playground, a community garden. And they invited all of these different groups to come over the course of a day. And it was in April, just when lockdown was kind of opening, was ending and things were opening up. And we got to be part of it. And it was, like, the most joyous day ever because we all got to be together on this, in this amazing project. And they were looking at how do you actually capture the things being discussed. So they made all these props from these huge pillows that you can have pillow fights with to talk about how councillors battle it out to decide what's the most important thing for them to achieve. Or this big scarf that was, like, the boundary of land and how that's changed over time. And they made these amazing papier-mâché heads with school children in Stratford of all the important figures like Jane Jacobs and Colin Ward in the discussion around common land. So the whole room is, like, a kind of, I guess, expression of the process that they've gone through. And And then you come into Play Without Grounds that was designed by VPPR, and that's really looking at how there's no space for teenagers, and it's this huge pink kind of spherical climbing frame. And it's creating a space for teenagers, but in their own words and on their own terms. So they worked with a social scientist to interview teenagers. There's about 3 hours of recorded interviews that you can listen to. But the idea is that there's space for people to just hang out and have fun in, but also to have important conversations and to stay busy. And the whole thing was designed by an adventure playground engineer and was supposed to be climbed on and experienced, but because of COVID, it was there more as like a static sculpture. So at 6 p.m. when the pavilion closed, the designer Catherine from VPPR was in Venice, and so Maddie, Catherine, and I got to climb the structure, which was really like amazing way to close out this experience, because we finally got to see what like the experience we'd been working so hard to create. We finally got to experience it, and the hope is when it comes back to the UK that lots of actual teenagers can have that experience as well. And then finally, when you get back into the garden square room, it's been transformed into a garden of delights. And like in that case here, we're no longer talking just about garden squares, but maybe the importance of green space, especially during the pandemic. Outdoor green space was like the one place where you could actually safely come together. And while a lot of the exhibition was built pre-COVID, and we think all of these issues are important regardless of the pandemic, we used audio throughout the pavilion to capture like maybe what's changed or what's become more urgent. And so there's like a series of audio recordings, and the most heartbreaking one is by these recordings by children of, you know, where are their favorite green spaces, but also like who would they like to see in those spaces that isn't in there right now. And that was really like affected by coronavirus, where we couldn't really meet people who are vulnerable or maybe lived further away. And it's a kind of telling signal of our times. And there's different zones. We're looking at how do people stay in outdoor spaces for longer. There's issues of safety and lighting, or issues of like access to power or shelter. And how do we actually design these spaces to host people for longer periods of time? And then there's a surprise seventh room in the basement of the pavilion, which is the public toilet, which is a taboo subject that people don't talk about enough. But without toilets, our access to public space is like completely limited, because we're on a leash from our houses. And the British Pavilion is one of the few pavilions that has toilets, but no one really knows about them because they're only really for use by the invigilators during the Biennale. And when we went there the first time, we realized that they existed, and that the British Pavilion becomes this hub during install periods because everyone wants to use their toilet. And so we thought it would be a great way to open them up, which wasn't really possible because of all the red tape around Italian regulations and like what you need for something to be a public toilet. But we decided to put it on display to start that conversation in the hope that in the future it will be opened up. But it also looked at the very terrible provision of public toilets in the UK and how they are often really spaces that other a lot of groups. Like there's a weight limits, there's time limits, and it's like just really violent. Like what happens, you get sprayed with water if you're in there for too long, or the doors will open. And, you know, if you're a carer and so you have to be in there with another person, or, you know, if you need to take a bit longer in there, that like, you know, you could just be completely exposed, is just like a horrific thing to have happened. And in our catalog, there's a great contribution by Mark Freeman, who writes about a lot of the research they've been doing that they did actually as I think the thesis project on the provision of public toilets and what needs to change. So that was a very long walkthrough.
This is a fantastic walkthrough, because I think, like you said, like I'm in awe. I'm absolutely blown away, because you've put it all together with Maddie. You got the team. There was Brexit, there was COVID, there was 1 year's delay. It's incredible. It sounds just exactly what we need. And like you say, in COVID, it's just so many issues have been heightened. But you were already thinking about it before it's hit all of us, before we would walk past the square and could not enter, although there was nobody else inside. Before we had to, I remember having to plan my runs around, I couldn't do my usual loop because all the toilets were shut and I had to have access to them in certain periods of a month. So I just could not go for my long run. So I had to do loops around the house because it was shut. And I heard so many stories of pregnant women, for example, or women with children, that they just cannot do their usual kind of walks because they have to be so mindful of a toilet, of a public toilet space that they can use. So the limitations have been absolutely huge. And you know, I have to admit, I never thought about teenagers not having a space, a public space for them. But as soon as you said it, I thought, well, yes, because adults go to places, kids have playgrounds, teens have not much, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think VPPR framed it really well in their description that they wrote about their room. They said that teenagers are often too young for the pub, but too old for the playground. Mm. And they fall in this gap where, you know, other than a shopping mall where you're forced to buy something in order to stay there, they're viewed with suspicion wherever they go. And it's really problematic. And often that leads to them feeling like the only place that they can hang out in is their bedrooms. Or, you know, in some cases, they get pulled into gang violence and or to become part of gangs because there's nowhere else they can go. And they're like sitting targets for people to like just say, like, come join us. And so youth centers were a really important space for them to actually have space to meet friends and hang out. But because of a lack of funding, they're closing up and down the country. Mm. And it was really important that we didn't design on their behalf, but actually speak to them and design with them. So creating spaces that they'd actually want to spend time in. And so there's lots of little details in the, how that structure is designed in terms of the rungs are really widely spaced so that only like children of a certain age or people who have long limbs can, I mean, I found it quite challenging to climb this climbing frame. So clearly not even a teenager.
No, but that's, yeah, I'm mind blown. So there'll be links in show notes and I encourage everybody to have a look. And I'm so excited that it might be coming to the UK as well and that we get to experience it in person and that you continue the conversations as well. And we'll be slowly wrapping up our chats. It's absolutely flying by. But I just really, I'm so curious, how do you feel now after, because there's the personal lives that have been affected, but you've been so busy and it's such huge success and a really big moment with the pavilion as well. And like, what's next?
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of crazy because it's, I guess, like the longest time anyone's ever had to work on a pavilion. We were commissioned so early, then we had this year-long extension. So it's been kind of strange because I think both Maddie and I have been working on this, but we've also had to, like, you know, start working on other things in parallel. And so, yeah, there's like lots of interesting things that have come our way in the meantime, which I think we've been really lucky because I guess COVID put a pause on lots of things, but it allowed for other conversations to happen. And I've started working on this incredible project for a South Asia gallery in Manchester, where I'm working on the visitor experience because the whole gallery is being co-curated by 30 local individuals, some of whom are South Asian or some have a great interest in South Asia. And it's been a really rewarding experience because I've never really done a project on my own that's linked to my own identity. And there's like an amazing kind of nuclear physicist and mathematician who's part of the collective, and that's why it's made me like suddenly try and remember all of my, like, you know, limited knowledge of maths from my degree a long time ago. I've met all these amazing community organizers and people who've really been so resilient during COVID to bring a kind of diasporic community together, to provide support in different ways, and who've really like transformed Manchester into this incredible hub of activity, especially for things like South Asian Heritage Month. And getting to meet all of them and work with them has been really rewarding. But thinking of how to tell stories about South Asia in this gallery is also really exciting. And so that project's been keeping me really busy. And then in addition to that, like, I think just teaching at the AA and being back in person has been really exciting after a year online. And all my students are doing really exciting projects. So there's lots of stuff to still to do. And Maddie and I are now trying to figure out how to adapt the whole show to you know, various venues in the UK potentially. And so, yeah, it's going to be an exciting time ahead.
Yeah, so that's kind of the project keeps on giving, right? It's kind of,
yeah,
keeps rolling.
Lots of new ways. I mean, I've been on lots of really interesting advisory panels or judging things for how to rethink the public realm and the type of artworks that can engage people there. And so, yeah, the pavilion in many ways has brought so many opportunities up that could really transform the city. And it's really great to get to be part of those conversations. But yeah, it was a kind of like bittersweet moment to see the pavilion close. And having anticipated it for so long, it was kind of sad to see it end. But I guess, as we said before, it's just hopefully the beginning of lots of new things and more meaningful, active conversations actually back in the UK.
Absolutely,
with real people.
And maybe also it's, you know, it has to close so that it prompts you, okay, this is closed now, this is, that part is done, let's do something next.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was a kind of a really nice hopeful moment as well. And I think through, I guess, all the adversity of coronavirus, there was amazing moments of solidarity. And the Haewon Shin, who curated the Korean Pavilion, actually brought all the curators of the national pavilions together to create this curators collective. And that was really incredible. It started as a way for us to just support each other when everything was postponed and people were losing their funding or didn't, their shipments weren't able to arrive, and how we could pool resources. But it became an incredible network. And because so many of us, myself and Maddie included, couldn't go out for the opening, the Curators Collective, spearheaded by the Austrian curators, started a midissage at the halfway point. And so all of us went out then, and we organized all these walking tours and talks and parties. And it was like a really amazing celebration. And I think so often we get stuck in these silos where we only care about our own pavilion or our own project. And this was a real collaboration, and it was a great way to bring everyone together. And we got to make all these international friends. And it was, yeah, so there's been lots of really good things that have come out of it that I hope will continue for a long time to come.
That's absolutely brilliant. And thank you so much for your time today. I'm so excited that we talked and we did it in person as well. And I wish you absolutely all the best for next year and for the pavilion and the ideas within it to keep growing and keep giving back as well, kind of wherever the pavilion appears.
No, thank you so much. And like, hopefully you and all the listeners will come to the opening of, or the reopening of, the Garden of Privatized Delights when that happens.
We'd absolutely love to. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right, so we have quite a bit of homework to do, as my mind has been blown. And I hope you're feeling super inspired now as well. And we'll be making the most of Manji's public program of lectures. And we'll also, for now, digitally visit her British Pavilion installation. I've included all links in the show notes. And that's it for this episode. And whilst there's still one more episode in the season, I already want to give you a heads up that in February we'll have a special business season with experts from across the design sector giving top tips on how to run a creative business well in 2022. So expect lots of advice on branding, sales, photography, PR, and on social media as well. I think we can all benefit from that and have a bit of a refresh. And it doesn't matter where you are in the business, whether you're part of a larger company or a one-man band, one-woman band, one-person band. We will focus on advice that's applicable to all, that we can all benefit from. And if you're loving today's episode, please rate and review the pod in your podcast app. I love reading all the reviews. And you can share this episode on your Insta stories as well to help spread the word. And you can tag me at Justina Green so that I can repost it too. To find out more about the podcast, you can visit the website at ondesignpodcast.com. And to find out more about my illustration work, if you fancy doing so, you can hop over to justinagreen.com. Right, I can't wait to see you here next week. Bye for now.